This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
I dive into it, just like today. It's a common stage, you know. And then, oh, you're going to have to play the drum. Well, I don't know these drums. I haven't even touched them before.
And he said, well, make up your mind. Which are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm not going to stop.
So I asked the drum, please, you know. The drum has life, so I have to ask the drum. The drum responded to me.
But I remember that by the age of 11 or 12, I was already proselytizing among my friends not to believe anything that they were being taught about values.
Some days you didn't feel like it, but it didn't matter whether it was raining or whether there was a difficult terrain. You had to do it.
So it happened sometime between the age of 5 and 11. I don't know exactly when.
Hello and welcome. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller. With stories of journeys, changes, crossroads, getting better gas mileage from your karma.
Yes, and today we are speaking with octogenarians. Four stories, and what they have in common is that everybody's past 80. Not exactly a social issue, although with the new Social Security controversy, we seem to be moving from terms of benign infantilizing, isn't she feisty, or he's so spry, you know, to genuine hostility, those greedy geezers.
Mm-hmm. Is the existence of an 80-year-old actually justified by a redeeming social purpose? Are we just being sentimental?
Obsolescence. Being in touch with earlier times precludes being in touch with the present. Well, does it?
Some of these stories we've already broadcast, but we wanted to put together this collection just to remind ourselves of who's living among us. So here's one from when we drove up to a little town named Hopland, about an hour north of here, to a big outdoor environmental festival, and we met Doris Haddock.
For the first 89 years of her life, Doris Haddock managed to stay out of the headlines. But that didn't last.
There are two kinds of politics in the world. The politics of love and the politics of fear. Love is about cooperation.
This is Doris Haddock. I live in Dublin, New Hampshire. And I'm 93 years old. And now I've been on the road for 3 years, not walking, but ending up in airplanes for the last 3 years. And then, well, it took me 14 months to cross the country on foot.
On January 1st, 2000, Doris Haddock, who came to be known as Granny D, began a campaign to promote campaign finance reform by walking across the United States. And now she's flying about making speeches. We wanted to know, what got you here from wherever you were before?
Up through the age of 89, which was when I went on the trip. Well, I was, there were five of us, four girls and a boy. My father was a working man. He hadn't much schooling, probably through the eighth grade. I went to public schools, and I mostly was a clown. To get attention, I clowned, and I longed to be an actress. All through my high school, but I could see that there was no way that I was going to be able to do it because there was no means. Well, it seemed there was a boy who was in our class, who was president of the class in high school, came home at Christmas time, and he said, why are you doing here? I thought you were going to go to a school of the drama. And I said, there's no way I can do that. Yes, there is, he said. I'm working at Harvard Business School, and I can get you a job there. So he got me to the city, and I went to Emerson School. And I was there 3 years before I fell in love with someone. So we were married and had two children. And we were married for 62 years. And we put two kids through college. And we retired. I retired in 62, and he was 65. We had a wonderful 20 years, and then he got Alzheimer's, and he was sick for 10 years, and I took care of him.
We are the sons and daughters of liberty in that struggle. Indeed we are. Let us not shrink from the mission.
And when he died, I read an article in the paper about the corruption that was going on in the country. And first I had a group, we called ourselves Tuesday Morning Academy, Old Women, and we set up a petition, and the whole thing took us a couple, year and a half to get done. And we began then getting cookie cutter letters back from our senators saying, dear little old ladies, don't trouble yourselves. We are taking care of this. And my son said, come with me, I'm going to Florida. And on the way, we saw an old man in the middle of nowhere. And he had a bag on his back and a cane, and I said to my son, what is he doing in the middle of nowhere? And he said, he's on the road again. And I said, I'm going on the road. My son said, a lot of people go across the country, but they go for peace, or they go to self-satisfaction or to find themselves, but you really need to have a cause to do it. I said, oh, I have a cause, all right. He said, oh, campaign finance reform. And I said, yes. So we discussed it, and finally he said, well, if you train for it, I'll let you go. You know, they become your parent when you're 80 years old. So he put me through a year's training. So as I trained to be able to do 10 miles a day, I carried a 29-pack on my back through the hills of New Hampshire, and I couldn't find any organization that gave me the time of day except Common Cause, who finally said, well, what can we do for you? And I said, send notices to all your members in the 11 states in which I will be traveling and tell them that I'm traveling as a pilgrim. And that's what they did, and what happened. I don't know, it was hard. I didn't think of it as hard. I thought of it as a job, something you had to do. If you stopped, then everything that you'd done was gone. So the game was to finish it. And when I did, I got help, of course, all across. Thousands of people helped me, and thousands of people came out to cheer me on, and it was like a parade when I went about halfway across the country, when people began recognizing that I was established, doing something important. And the media all the way across, local media was wonderful. And it got so that people in Texas, it was a game to find Granny D. You know, they'd find me. I was like a bird hunt. You know, they'd find me, and then they'd call on their websites where I was. We were not supposed to go on the interstates. We went on what they call the frontage roads, and on rare occasions when we had to go on the interstate because there was no frontage road. It was against the law, of course, but I never got picked up.
We didn't talk a lot about the hike itself, which took 14 months, included desert exhaustion, blizzards, crossing mountains on skis, 10 miles a day for 14 months. You can read about it on the web or in her recent book. I asked, what gave you the idea that you could possibly do that?
I don't know. I can't imagine why ever in the world I thought I could do it. It was crazy. It really was. But I had complete faith in myself that all I needed to do was put a pack on my back with 5 pounds of trail mix, which I had eaten for a week, and knew I could do it if I had to, and the sleeping bag. And I had lain on the ground in the woods for a month in cold weather in the sleeping bag, which is a stunt if you're 89 and you need to get out a couple of times in the night. I also I knew that if I wasn't able to accomplish it or didn't find it fun, my son insisted that I go out and thumb a distance, and so I got out. I had to go to a funeral up north in New Hampshire, and I brought my pack, my sleeping bag and trail mix, and I started thumbing. And people that were between the ages of 18 and 30, all who had done the same thing, picked me up. And I talked about campaign finance reform, and they got rid of me as fast as they could. But I traveled 250 miles in a day, and that was all I needed to prove to my son that I could do it.
On the trip, she celebrated her 90th birthday. She finished the hike. She was in the headlines. She got her moment of fame. It was finished. But not quite.
I do not mean that the politicians necessarily know what they are doing. The corruption is so immense that they cannot even see it, even when it pays the finances for their re-election. How free are you now, my friends? Check your bills and your bank account. How much time the Bush administration, you can call them neos or neoliberals or neoconservatives, though they're neo-nothing except perhaps neo-colonial and neolithic.
The only time I got arrested was when I went with a group into the People's Hall in the Capitol. They come and announce with a bullhorn three times that you are trespassing. And of course we say that this is our hall, and the Constitution says if you object to what is going on in your government, it's your citizen's duty to do something about it. So that's what we did, and we were arrested and just taken to a holding cell while we were fingerprinted, and then we had to come back in a couple of months and appear before a judge. And he could have charged us $500 or kept us for 6 months, but he didn't either, and said that the least he could do was to charge us $10 each, and said that he appreciated what we had done, and that what was done was needed to be done, that sometimes the populace gets ahead of the government, and you need to then wake up the masses to let them know that what is going on in the government. So that's what we did. Yes, that is true. I do feel that it's finished. I've done what I proposed to do, but I'm very greedy. I want more. It changed my life, and when I returned to where I was previously, I found it very difficult in a lot of ways. One thing, I had received a great deal of attention. Now I wasn't Granny D anymore, I was just Doris Haddock. But what is important, it wasn't me, it had nothing to do with me. It is the mission. And that mission was in my mind and my being, so that it took over, and it was the only thing that mattered to me.
In the past 3 years, she's made countless speeches. She's written a book. During the final debate on the McCain-Feingold bill, she circled the Capitol building for 7 days, the last three 24 hours a day. And speeches planned weekly around the country for the full year up to this election, with a single message: vote.
The forces of life and death are in struggle, for those are the other names for love and fear. Let us choose life, let us choose love, and happily use ourselves up in this service. Thank you.
There were five of us, and I always felt and do think that being a second girl gives an entirely different attitude towards life. I don't think it's as bad to be a second boy as it is to be a second girl. and you fight like mad for your place in the sun.
In Hopland, California, we were talking with Doris Haddock. You can read an archive of Doris's speeches at www.grannyd.com.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. The next story was harder to put together because 82 years of hopscotching across continents is kind of hard to follow.
Well, yeah, but it stopped being confusing for me when I realized, okay, he's a musician. His narrative is really a musical line. He's lived his life not by manager's logic, but more the way a musician finds the next note that wants to happen after the one that came before. And then it makes perfect sense.
Every summer, we go to a big music and dancing festival in western New York State called Starwood. For a number of years, we'd seen this extraordinary drummer, Halim Eldab, white-haired, very intense, and very peaceful. We knew that he was retired from teaching at Kent State, we knew he was a friend of the great African drummer Olatunji, and that he was Egyptian. But when we finally talked, it was a talk that held a lot of surprises.
82 years, yeah. I was born in Cairo, Egypt, 1921. Always exposed to music since I was born. I probably was born playing the drum. I grew up, studied French, Arabic, and graduated from Cairo University of Agriculture. I played the piano, even though I was in agriculture, I learned how to play the piano. And as I said, I composed by myself without any much education then, but I had the tendency to compose. And there was a competition for composition and piano at the opera house, Cairo, you know, the one was built for Aida in the 1800s. So I went there and got the first prize in piano and the first prize in composition, 1942. 1944, I graduated from the agricultural school and started working as an agriculturalist. I continued my work in agriculture and was able to develop and have a good position until 1948 when I wrote a composition about what was going on in the war. And it was called It Is Dark and Damp on the Front. And it was written about what's happening in Palestine, actually. And I've said that the war is not really there, but it's in the heart of every human being, that the war will continue because we have it. It's the fear within and the war within us that really is the real thing. So I said the dark and dampness is within us. And that was my avant-garde composition. It was very not following any rules or anything, and was played at a center in Cairo called All Saints Cathedral. It was a huge cathedral by the Nile where people were invited all over the world. There were people from France and England and Germany. Suddenly I was exposed at the All Saints Cathedral. A newspaper wrote about me, French paper and everybody, and I was called an international composer overnight. So things happened so fast that my life, my boss in agriculture had a heart attack. He said, I'm going to starve in music. He said, how could you leave all this profession and the great position you have? Well, the music was holding on to me. I've always liked to write music.
Halim was invited for performances to France, Germany, finally the United States, met Aaron Copland, Koussevitzky, Bernstein, Stravinsky, John Cage, and became part of an experimental music scene that was exploding in the 1950s.
Yeah, I mean, I came to... To me, Cairo and New York, there are similarities in a way. It's so crowded, it's so incredible. The little pockets all over, and every pocket is different. It was, you know, incredible to see the skyscrapers and be... I loved George Washington Bridge because I've never seen so many roads coming in and out, and the traffic and the feeling of iron everywhere. I felt that iron, and then... like the god Ogun of the Yoruba people, the god of iron. So I saw all this iron. And iron is a very important part, yet it's a very threatening thing, because if you abuse iron will abuse you. And that's the god Ogun of the Yoruba, the holder of the double sword, you know. So you have to be careful. You have to have the wisdom of using the iron. You can't just use iron, because otherwise it'll come back to you.
One might ask, why is a classically based avant-garde composer talking about Yoruban deities. Well, his coming to America took him back to Africa, recording indigenous music for the Smithsonian, Nigeria, the Congo, Niger, Senegal, Ghana, Angola. He talked about his own journey of spirit.
Well, I was actually exposed to Islam and Coptic Christian. A lot of orientations, a lot of philosophers in my family, especially with some of my older brothers. So it's like a lot of opening. I participate in Islamic practices as well as Coptic or Christian. I see it's all connected to me. I don't see a separation, but I see the depth of it all. I see the real depth. So even though I'm like the Yoruba people, the Yoruba could be Christian or Muslim, but they retain the Yoruba tradition because it's prime connection to the earth, prime connections to the air, the fire, the stones, the lightning, all the makeup, because you don't forget that every stone has life in it. Because once you forget that there is life in the tree, you chop the tree down, you destroy part of yourself. Once you forget that too, the air is a god, you're going to pollute the air. Once you forget the ocean is pure water, you're going to pollute it. So I forget this thing is sacredness. But whatever, and what we do, it's not a matter of stopping pollution, it's a matter of self-abuse. Because every time I abuse the water, I'm abusing really myself. So every time I see abuse of air, abuse of the fact that the earth, we forgot that the earth has pulse, and it's alive, and it's been alive, and will always be alive. You know, the earth keep moving. No matter what we do, we keep destroying, we keep wars and all that. It's a result of fear. It's not a result of anything. You know, why should I war with somebody unless I'm afraid? I'm afraid of something. So if I'm afraid of something, I'm going to attack you. If I'm not afraid, why should I attack you? You know, why should I bother? You know, I should celebrate, not attack. I had a lot of experiences in the Congo. I was doing ceremony, and then the priestesses made sign on me and tried to keep me. And a recovered woman that was recovered was supposed to ask the crocodile god what she needs because she recovered. And she had to make one choice, and the choice was to get the stranger to be her husband. But she made a mistake. She said, I want him to shave his beard. I had a huge beard. And that kept me away. If she didn't say that, I would never be here. The crocodile would hold me there. So I kind of ran away and ended up facing the gendarme, the military of the Angola fighters. A lorry took me and my friend's wife into a prison camp. And I didn't know what to do. Well, I managed to get out of there. The guy told me to get out, get lost, because he didn't want me around. Because I was representing, really, the Smithsonian. I didn't go to any Europeanized, any place. I went straight to the villages. I slept in the village. I slept on the floor. I slept in thatch roof houses. I mixed with the people that can take me or leave me. And a lot of people who would do the research would come to a comfortable hotel. And then from the comfortable hotel, they invite people to come to them and they record them. But I never did that. I went straight to the villages. I just, sometime like in Mali, I was out there. They didn't know why I was there. And they asked me to report every day in a village that dances. They want to know where I'm going because I didn't have a plan of recording in Mali. But I was out in the street and there was a marriage ceremony. I just walked behind them and I walked miles and miles. They ended up everybody inviting me. So I ended up in a marriage ceremony, ended up living with the people, ended up recording what I wanted. It was just like that. Another time, also in Mali, ran into a person in a car. He wanted to go to his land in central Mali. And he was talking to a friend and talked to me and ended up asking me if I could drive him. in the middle of the night, and he had this Citroën car with no windshield wipers, used to wipe it with hand, ended up driving to central Mali and learned about the rice growers and their music and the community there, and slept there and get to know it. So it's like you encounter and you move with the encounter. You feel that there's some direction happening. Yeah, I never really plan a very solid plan when I go to African nations, like a rhythm, you know. I have a solid way of looking at the world, and I respect everything. That's probably basic. I respect everybody that I see, every human being that I meet, every little kid, the environment I respect. So I respect everything that I encounter. I never feel like, yes, no one can do that. Yeah, another thing, I really never say no, maybe.
His long resume of never saying no resulted in symphonies, operas, a piece for Martha Graham, last year a new work to celebrate the reopening of the library at Alexandria, this year a theater piece on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. I asked, is your life in America as exciting as your travels?
I feel like music is really part of my life, and that music and vibration is part of every human being. And that color, you know, the way I compose is that I see my sound. I see it instantly. And I could hear color. And this crossing feeling is very important, and I was trying to give it to the students that studied with me. The crossing of senses, where you can really see the sound, and that makes me write very fast. I see the color, the texture, the sound, so I can sit down, but it takes time to physically put it on paper because, you know, 45 minutes of music that comes instantly, it takes days of working, of course, interruptions and activities and jobs and all that. So this is the most prime things, I think. I think how to develop prime contact to musical sound, to bring the reality. Well, my being struck by lightning was a very awakening feeling. That's true, you know, I was struck by lightning about 40 years ago, thrown out to the air. I was in Newton, Massachusetts, when Shango visited me, the lightning. It was incredible. I mean, it was raining outside where I was staying, and I ran out to bring the furniture in, and lightning came straight at me. And so I was thrown about 10 feet in the air and landed down on my back. It's like shaking, and I was all numb for a while. There was a voice that came out, a huge voice that came out of me when I was struck. Like not a voice of fear, but it was a voice of just like another thunder coming out of me. Thunder with thunder. It was just like a roaring back into the thunder of Shango. Yeah, I stayed conscious. I didn't lose consciousness. It's amazing. I just felt all the energy. I told my wife, why didn't you tell the people that a composer did? At least let them know I'm a composer that was struck. And the doctor who saw me said, oh, it's a good thing it didn't kill you. He said, well, maybe you cured your asthma. I used to have bad asthma. It's not as bad now. So it kind of balanced me out.
In Sherman, New York, we were talking with Halim Eldab. The music you heard was from an 80-minute CD of his music that's included in a biography called The Musical World of Halim Eldab by Denise Sechrist, published by Kent State University Press.
Another CD, Crossing the Electric Magnetic, is available from Without Fear Records, www.purpleman.com. And you can hear some bits on the website. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. Thank you.